Well, election week and election day, they've just wrapped up. I hope you voted and did your part as a citizen of this great country. I'm going to miss all those campaign commercials on the radio, TV, and internet. Not. You know, you look at the money spent on these types of political campaigns, we could use those dollars and definitely solve some national problems, maybe even solve some global problems. It's just unbelievable, mind-boggling how much money is spent on these. Anyways, you know, elections, they come and go, but Far Middle episodes, they are a constant. This week, of course, we're at episode 77. Dedication is going to go to two number 77s in the sport of hockey, both being defensemen, one who set new norms for the position and one who came to epitomize the position over a long career as an elder statesman, so to speak. So the first 77 dedication is for Paul Coffey. He's one of my favorite hockey players to watch of all time. Now, Coffey wore 77 later in his career after Edmonton, where he was a number 7. He was 77 with the Penguins and the Red Wings and the Flyers. Sort of still hurts to think of him in a Flyers uniform, but anyway. And he also wore 77 for a host of other teams in his career after Edmonton. And when he went from the Oilers to the Penguins, Rod Buskus, if you guys remember that name, Rod Buskus was a veteran defenseman for the Penguins who had number 7 already. And when Coffey came to the Penguins, he offered up his number 7 to Coffey. Paul said he was fine and instead went with 77, which he first wore on Team Canada just before joining the Penguins. And then 77 it was for the rest of his career. So Coffey was so fun to watch. Just watching him skate alone was worth the price of admission. So fast. Three-time Norris Trophy winner. Holds the record still for the most goals ever by a defenseman in one season at 48. He and Orr are the only defensemen to ever tally 100-point seasons more than once. By the way, Coffey did it 5 times, Orr did it 6 times. Just think about that. I think he holds dozens, I want to say almost like 30 or maybe 30-plus NHL records in total from regular season to career to playoffs. 4 Stanley Cups, 3 with the Oilers and Gretzky, and 1 with the Penguins and Mario Lemieux. So he sort of won cups with the 2 greatest players probably in the history of hockey. And a true mold breaker that took the prototype, sort of blew it apart, and built something no one saw before. Now, what about our second number 77 NHL defenseman dedication? Well, Coffey ranks 2nd all-time among NHL defensemen in goals, assists, and points, behind only one other person. And that person at the top spot was a 77 as well, and had one of the longest, most storied career runs in hockey history. His name is Ray Bourque. So Coffey, I said, won 3 Norris trophies. Bourque won 5. 21 years he spent with the Bruins. He's the longest serving captain in that storied franchise's history. He ended his career, of course, with the Colorado Avalanche, where he won the Stanley Cup in the last game of his pro career. Now, some called it a storybook ending. Some sort of criticized him for switching teams to chase a ring, or he's accused of that. But either way, you know, you can say the last game of his career, his long career, it was a game where he won the Stanley Cup. Interestingly, there is some Far Middle intrigue with Bourque in his number 77 that mirrors Coffey in his switch from 7 to 77 as well. So Bourque, like Coffey, started out as a number 7 with the Bruins, which was the number Bruins legend Philip Esposito won before he had retired. And the Bruins were going to retire number 7 in Esposito's honor, but allow Bourque to wear it for as long as he liked. So Bourque ends up during the ceremony on ice for Esposito's retirement number. He surrenders the number 7 to Esposito and basically unveils his new 77 jersey there in Boston Garden. And the rest, of course, was history. Yes, this episode dedication goes to 2 defensemen in the NHL, 77s who were once 7s. One broke the mold and redefined a position, while the other epitomized longevity over a career. Here's to Paul Coffey and Ray Bourque. And we are off and running with making those connections that we always do in the Far Middle. Now, no one disputes that Coffey and Bourque paid their dues to get to the summits of their careers. That's what I love about sports. It's a meritocracy. There's basically no way around paying your dues. Unfortunately, that is not the case when it comes to our next topic, which is riders on public transportation these days. So let's start by asking ourselves some questions. What might happen if society starts to implement a few less than optimal traits? Things like not enforcing fares on subways and buses, or decriminalizing crimes, or looking the other way when riders are jumping turnstiles. basically what would happen if you're not running public transportation or public businesses as an investment that needs to get a rate of return on taxpayer money, and instead you're simply throwing dollar after dollar into it, no matter what those rates of return or lack thereof might be. Well, if you apply these things, you're going to end up with what is occurring in major public transportation networks all over this nation of ours. And you don't have to look any further than our nation's capital, which is unfortunate irony in this instance. The Washington Metropolitan Area Transit Authority, it's experiencing a third of riders refusing to pay fares on buses. Now, if the rider doesn't pay up and is riding the bus in Virginia or Maryland in the DC suburbs, they're going to be committing a criminal offense and face whatever the consequences might be. But if the same rider who doesn't pay the fare is riding within DC itself, DC City Council had the wisdom of decriminalizing fare evasion a couple of years ago. So back in the day, when rules were enforced, a rider who didn't pay a fare, they'd be hit with a $300 fine or something in that neighborhood, and possibly worse, possible jail time depending on the circumstances. Today, the worst that a fare evader can expect to receive in DC itself is a $50 civil fine. But that's even rare, because why would transit cops or DC police end up enforcing something that city council says is not worth enforcing? Thus, fare evaders, they're now a third, as I said, of the riders on the system, which wrecks the already poor finances of the public transportation network, which then fleeces taxpayers and paying customers even more. So this all adds up when you run the math. For the DC Transit Network, when you add these things up, it says for half the fiscal 2022 year, 9 million bus rides were not paid with a fare, 9 million trips. And in 2021, transit cops took a grand total of 297 fare enforcement actions out of 9 million free trips, which is an enforcement hit rate of something like 0.003%. So those unpaid trips, they would have been $40 million in fares. And by the way, the Transit Authority is running a $185 million budget deficit, so they can use the fare revenue. And if you compare the 9 million rides without paying bus fare and the 297 enforcement actions to prior years, you'll see the problem of fare evasion is exploding and the enforcement of fares is falling off of a cliff. But both should be expected when you remove any consequence for bad actions. There's that famous theory of the tragedy of the commons, of course. And then there is this ridiculous situation created by inept leadership from a city council that, by the way, represents the capital city of the most powerful nation on the planet. It's not a good optic, it's not a good precedent, and it's certainly not a good example. So, you've got this endless pouring of taxpayer money into public transit that less and less people want to ride, or many who do are riding, but they don't pay the fares. That brings us to the next topic or connection. There's a lot that our large cities are struggling with, right? We just talked about broken public transportation. We've got crime issues, we've got failing public schools, you got inflation and the rising cost of living. And of course, you've got hollowed out downtowns that we're seeing everywhere post-pandemic, and the list goes on. But there is one arena where large cities and states, they've done very well in the past 2 years, and that is their fiscal and budget coffers are overflowing, or at least they had been. Now, why is that? Well, similar to the specific example of funding of public transportation, because the federal government and Congress, they've turned the stimulus spigot wide open on state and local governments since 2020. And you've got hundreds of billions of dollars in direct federal aid since 2020 and pandemic, and depending on how you account for it, up to $1 trillion more dollars in indirect federal and taxpayer dollars from various other programs. You couple all that with what was a booming stock market that was inflated by zero interest rates and quantitative easing from the Fed, and you've got a massive stimulus inflow, massive tax receipts, and large budget surpluses on the state and local levels of government. But all that is drastically changing as we speak. Why is it changing? Well, a couple of basic but fundamentally crucial reasons. First, states and local government are seeing all that inflow of money, and guess what they're deciding to do? They're deciding to spend more, way more. The average state nominal budget increase in 2022 was almost 15%. That's over four times prior year's increases, depending on your year of comparison. And that newfound money is quickly burning a hole in the state government pockets. Second, the stock market, it's not doing well, in case you haven't looked at your 401k or investment account statements lately. which means capital gains taxes and other investment income taxes, they're going to be a fraction of what they were the past few years. So there's $6 trillion less in shareholder wealth since the start of 2022. $6 trillion, that's the cumulative impact of sort of the market chaos that we've seen so far this year. And that is growing. It's getting worse as the market continues to languish. So state and local tax revenues are going to suffer as a key piece of that revenue pie starts to disappear. And then third, interest rates are going up, which means the interest expense for debt loads on governments, they're going to go up with the higher rates as states have to finance and refinance their debt. So watch that 10-year treasury bill yield as it climbs. So will interest expense for state and local governments, which will hit, of course, government budgets. And then fourth, the final one, as we discussed in prior episodes of the Far Middle from time to time, high taxes in big cities in certain states like California and New York, Illinois, they're pushing high-income residents out. So they are moving to low-tax states like Florida and Texas because why? They rationally want to keep more of their value and not have it appropriated by government, particularly inept government. So I saw some data recently on income gain and loss migration for different states. California is down $18 billion in adjusted gross income cumulatively in 2020. New York was actually worse, New York State. Florida was up over $20 billion in adjusted gross income in 2020. In counties, if you look at this on a county level, they show in some instances even more interesting data from the year 2020. New York County, which of course is New York City, lost over $14 billion in outflows. So you see what is happening. You've got these affluent or high earners who are moving away from high taxes as if they're being repulsed almost by a physical force. And what are they doing? They're being attracted to low tax regions and states. And that's going to impact state and local government budgets. It's inevitable. So you add all of this up, these four sort of drivers or factors, and you can see how the fiscal pendulum for state and local governments, particularly high tax ones, that pendulum is swinging in the opposite direction. Now, to what extent and for how long, it's going to be interesting to watch to see what the answers to those two questions are. And I'd advise you to watch it, constant listeners, because it's a major issue and it can change quickly and then impact all kinds of other things that are going to affect you directly, no matter what state or county you call home. And if you think that city councils, like ones in our nation's capital, or how state and local governments are not exerting reasonable fiscal discipline, is factor shift, if you think those are exemplifying poor leadership, just consider it could be worse, as in it could be on par with the shameful lack of leadership coming out of the Vatican when it deals with one of its own, Cardinal Zen from China. Now, constant listeners know that I'm Catholic, and I'm also not a big supporter of Pope Francis. I dedicated a chapter in my book, Precipice, The Left's Campaign to Destroy America, on this topic, and I encourage you to buy a copy and give it a read if you get a chance. The Pope is focused on matters that have nothing to do with Catholic doctrine. He lectures about climate change science as if he were a climatologist. He likes to attack capitalism as if he were an economist. He's giving Putin or has given Putin a soft pass on Ukraine as if he was head of the UN or Henry Kissinger. The Pope clearly disdains the United States for whatever reasons, and he's displayed socialist tendencies to the point where you wonder if he's more of a political ideologue than leader of the Catholic faith. And while Francis is distracted on topics that he knows little about and ones that are far afield from issues of Catholic faith and morals, he ignores crises where his leadership and support could make huge positive differences. Now, one extreme example of this is the imprisonment and trial of a 90-year-old cardinal. It's Cardinal Zen in China, as I mentioned. And Cardinal Zen's nickname is Tiger, and for good reason. He's been a champion of Catholics in China since the 1980s, and he's come to understand over time that the Chinese Communist Party's sole intention is to tear down Catholicism and rebuild it as an instrument to basically support the state. It's a religious form of propaganda once rebuilt, so to speak. That's the intention. Now, Cardinal Zen understands his duty, and he's resisted the Chinese Communist Party for years, to the point where now the government has jailed him at 90 years of age, for a nonprofit legal defense fund that he was associated with, and it puts him on trial by arguing that his involvement in the legal defense fund was a violation of a money laundering law that was meant to stop terrorists or revolutionary groups. So this sham is actually an improvement from what the cardinal was facing when this all started, which was a charge of colluding with foreign forces, which could have resulted in a life sentence potentially. Now, Pope Francis, he's been turning a deaf ear toward Cardinal Zen for years. And why is the Pope ignoring a cardinal who's defending Chinese Catholics and that is now jailed by a regime that is anti-Catholic and anti-religion? Because of a couple of potential reasons, at least from my perspective. First, as I said, the Pope is anti-capitalist, anti-America, and anti-West, which could be interpreted as pro-China by inference. Second, China represents a huge market opportunity, let's call it, for the Vatican. There's a lot of people in China, lots of potential Catholics in China. So the Pope may not be psyched up for taking on a totalitarian regime in China if it closes off his, let's call it, market opportunity. Maybe he's a more self-interested capitalist than he cares to admit. Third, there's a little vanity that could be at play here. You know, what if Pope Francis becomes the Pope who seals the deal with China and opens it to the Catholic Church? The optic of a mass held in Tiananmen Square, it just might be too tempting. Now, by the way, Pope Francis, his actions with Cardinal Zen, they're consistent with other troubling actions that he's taken on China. There's an agreement between the church and the Chinese Communist Party that remains undisclosed. No one knows what was agreed to due to its secrecy. It's been pretty clear that the Chinese Communist Party has veto and appointment power for Chinese bishops over the Vatican and the Pope, which is sort of crazy when you think about it, because one of the clearest powers the Pope has is to appoint the leaders of the church. But not in China. There's the Chinese Communist Party, which is going to have the ultimate say, which is one of the ways the Chinese Communist Party, as I mentioned, will tear down the traditional legacy of the church and build in its place a new Catholicism in China, one that's going to preach the virtues of communism and the state and Xi and the Chinese Communist Party. It's the same entities, by the way, that historically have killed countless Catholics the world over. Now, again, I'm Catholic, but I'm not always proud of what the Vatican's doing. History informs me on that. It backs me up on that. The Vatican's behavior in World War II with fascism and the Jews, not good. How the Iron Curtain was dealt with, also not good. And now how Francis is appeasing China and looking to harm the true beacons of hope out there in the world like America. So, you know, say a prayer for Cardinal Zen if you were the praying type, and root for him no matter what your religious affiliation might be if you care about individual rights and freedom. Makes fare evasion, I guess, in D.C. on buses look like small stuff in the grander scheme of things. Now, of course, the Pope, he fancies himself a climate expert, as I mentioned, which meanders us to the next topic to connect to. I was reading a highly reputable business paper recently, front page, section A, the whole front section of the paper and the front page of it. And a couple of articles across that front page and section A got my attention. One was how the Biden administration was slowing oil leasing on federal lands more than any administration at this point in a term since World War II. Now, that, of course, curtails supplies of things like oil and natural gas. Then there was another headline about permitting reform and how whatever backroom deal Senator Manchin struck with fellow Democrats, it's not going to allow for the completion of certain pipelines that have been held up by government, environmentalists, and lawsuits for years now, which also, of course, is going to curtail supply of oil and natural gas. And then there was another headline, an article, about how California and the Biden administration, they're issuing all kinds of new climate policies and regulations to officially save the planet, but in reality do nothing but harm quality of life. All, of course, will end up resulting in creating energy scarcity and curtailing supplies of oil and natural gas. But then the last article that I read got my attention, which was more of an analysis, I'll call it, by a journalist and an economist. And it was discussing inflation and in a discussion about what to do about inflation to get it under control. And the author referenced the price of natural gas being a problem when it comes to inflation and recession risk, and how the high price of natural gas was caused by what he pegged, quote, an artificial shortage of natural gas engineered by Putin, end quote. What? Wait a minute. Either the author is very confused on cause and effect, or the author knows better and is towing the ideological talking points for the cause of the left, because there is indeed an artificial shortage of natural gas. But Putin is not the cause of it. He's a symptom, just like the artificial shortage of natural gas is a result of the same thing. And that thing is climate energy policies and actions that the other articles referenced in their totality, cumulatively, having an intended impact. And what are the intended impacts? Well, it's impacts on natural gas and oil supply, on energy costs, on geopolitical volatility and insecurity, on warmongering, on inflation, and on recession risk. So environmentalists and the climate czar and the left and the Biden administration and the UN, all those code redders, they caused this current global mess we're in with their damaging prescriptions and policies. You remove the policies and watch that artificial shortage of energy disappear quickly, and inflation will then disappear with it. And until you remove this form of state intervention under cover of saving the planet and allow the free market and the private sector to do what they do, until you do those things, the symptoms will not go away and the symptoms are only going to get worse. So maybe the author is showing us with sort of this, shoddy analysis, what happens these days when you mix biased journalism with stacked economics. One section of one day's paper sort of summed up the entire climate policy scheme in a very neat package, if you are able and willing to look across articles and start to connect them together. Ah, connections, right? The essence of the far middle for 77 episodes and running. Now, I don't want to leave you with the impression that I was looking to insult the journalist on our last topic. I'm a big believer, of course, in freedom of the press, but I also want my newspapers of choice to exercise at least a modest level of integrity and rigor. We should demand that of such an important institution, or at least what once used to be such an important institution. And to give you assurance that I didn't mean to be mean, nor was hurtful, let's close with a few truly hurtful comments that were made about prior presidents. I thought you'd enjoy these at the close for 77. So let's start, I'll go through this chronologically, sequencing presidents. Let's start with FDR, Franklin Roosevelt. How about this one? If he became convinced tomorrow that coming out for cannibalism would get him the votes he sorely needs, he would begin fattening a missionary in the White House backyard. That quote was from H.L. Mencken. I thought that was a pretty nasty one. How about a noted socialist at the time and what this individual said about Harry Truman? Harry Truman proves the old adage that any man can become president of the United States. Ouch. The hero of World War II, Dwight Eisenhower, Ike, he had some hurtful things thrown his way. This comes from Lyndon Johnson, another president. Quote, I don't know how many times I pulled that bumbling, brain-lack, bubbleheads, chestnuts out of the fire, and he never thanked me once. That's mean, LBJ. JFK, John Kennedy, he took heat from Barry Goldwater. Barry Goldwater said about JFK, I sincerely fear for my country if Jack Kennedy should be elected president. The fellow has absolutely no principles. Money and gall are all the Kennedys have. Well, that's nasty. Now, I mentioned Lyndon Johnson, LBJ. He took a lot of criticism. He dished out criticism, but he also took a lot of criticism. A journalist once described LBJ as follows. He turned out to be so many different characters, he could have populated all of War and Peace and still had a few people left over. Thought that was a pretty good one, literary reference. But no one took more heat than Richard Nixon. Hunter Thompson went to special extents to vilify him, as only Hunter Thompson could do. Here's what Hunter Thompson said about Nixon. He was a foul caricature of himself, a man with no soul, no inner convictions, with the integrity of a hyena and the style of a poisoned toad. Wow, that is not nice. Now, Gerald Ford, he was a president that seemed to be pretty hard to hate, especially coming after Nixon. But it did stop some from taking a run at him. LBJ, he's going to appear again. LBJ said about Ford, he's a nice guy, but he played too much football with his helmet off. Thought that was pretty funny. Now, a labor leader had this to say about Jimmy Carter. He's your typical smiling, brilliant, backstabbing, BSing Southern nutcutter. I paraphrase there to keep the far middle's PG rating intact. Ronald Reagan is an easy one to find biting criticism on, but it's tough to pick just one. So how about this one from, of all people, Barry Goldwater? I wouldn't think he would be a big critic of Reagan, but here's what he said about Reagan. He can't decide whether he was born in a log cabin or a manger. Thought that was pretty good. George Bush the First. I have to go with this one. Being in the energy industry, which comes from a Texas bureaucrat. This might be my favorite one of the bunch. If ignorance ever goes to $40 a barrel, I want drilling rights on George Bush's head. That's good. Bill Clinton, he offers, yet another treasure trove of quotes to select from. How about this one from Ross Perot? Remember Ross Perot? quote, "Nobody likes to be called a liar, but to be called a liar by Bill Clinton is really a unique experience," end quote. It's pretty good, Ross. George Bush II, I quote a favorite of mine from the late, great Christopher Hitchens. I love Christopher Hitchens, but here's what he had to say about George Bush II. "Usually uncurious, abnormally unintelligent, amazingly inarticulate, fantastically uncultured, extraordinarily uneducated, and apparently quite proud of all these things." That basically sounds like Christopher Hitchens talking right there. And then finally, President Obama. This came from a journalist. "Barack Obama's presidency will go down in history as 8 years of boredom, punctuated by speeches and interviews." Ouch. Now, when it comes to Presidents Trump and Biden, I'm not going to go there. We would need an entire episode on those two, and we are out of time for episode 77, constant listeners. So enjoy the week ahead. See you on the other side with episode 78.